Talk Shoe. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes. At ESI Bytes, we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free and available when they're interested in listening to it. Today we have an excellent show made even more special because I'm turning the moderator role over to one of my former guests, Kelly Twigger, who offered to interview me on my area of expertise. And Kelly, like me, is an entrepreneurial lawyer. She's created a virtual law firm, ESI Attorneys, based in Wisconsin. And we did a previous show on ESI Bytes on data mapping and spent some time talking to legal tech in New York City, where Kelly asked me if I wanted someone to interview me. So, Kelly, why don't you take over the show here?
Well, thanks, Carl. It's a privilege to be able to take over the moderator on such a prestigious podcasting site. ESI Bytes is a wonderful source of information for everyone learning to learn some new pieces about electronic discovery. So I appreciate the opportunity today. Let's get started with doing what you usually do, which is interviewing the speaker, or introducing the speaker, I should say. Carl is an attorney with over 17 years of experience. He's got a dual degree MBA lawyer and has spent a good deal of his career as an entrepreneur working on fixing legal issues with a business person's perspective. Carl was a founder and CEO of Legal Network, a three-time Inc. 500 company, which staffed dozens of large e-discovery projects in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where he was awarded an Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year Award. Carl developed optimizing staffing software with Norm Clark, from Altman Wheel, called StaffRight. After selling Legal Network to Special Counsel, Carl developed an e-discovery best practices board game called Discovery Land, which I haven't gotten to see, but I'm very interested to do. The $50,000 bill in the board game was Tim Opsitnik from Juranov, who asked him to work with him at Juranov as his director of legal analytics and review. So word to the wise, I guess if you can create a board game, you might talk yourself into a job. At Juranov, Carl has also created ESI Bytes as a free podcast series to help educate practitioners on best practices in e-discovery. Carl has been published in books and articles on electronic discovery in dozens of publications and created the fourth C audiocast CLE series on e-discovery for BNA. Carl, thanks so much for joining us on the show as a guest.
Kelly, thanks for moderating. And I got to point out, I got two job offers. So while I didn't solve e-discovery with a board game, it did help me. So
good. Well, maybe you can put it out there for us all to see so we can figure it out. Carl, how did you first get interested in electronic discovery?
Well, back in 1994, I was an associate at a mid-sized law firm in Pittsburgh working in a huge multi-state litigation called the Farmore Securities MDL. And there were hundreds of lawyers on the case, three different deposition tracks around the country. It was really something to watch as a young lawyer. And I was brought in at this mid-sized firm and given a lot of responsibility early on for creating trial graphics and working with our new summation database, which frankly I was never properly trained on. And after spending 2 years doing single keyword searches for the bulk of the litigation, you know, which was sort of like building the pyramids in a large case like this, you know, I have felt the pain of technology about not being fully optimized personally. Then when running my own business at Legal Network, we staffed dozens of large projects, including one 200 attorney project, which lasted 5 years, and at the time was the largest in the country. I noticed at that stage there was not much attention being put on the management of what we now all recognize today as clearly the largest cost component of an e-discovery matter, which is the cost of paying people to review electronically stored information. So that got me interested in promoting better management of staffing, and that's how I got started publishing articles and speaking nationally on the e-discovery circuit in about 2004. And then in 2005, I realized I was really the only person speaking on this topic because I typically would have the last spot at a CLE conference, the 4 o'clock Friday speaking spot. But now everyone recognizes this issue, so that's sort of how I got involved in e-discovery.
Excellent. And I think one of the thing we're here to talk about today is concept searching So maybe you can explain to us what concept searching is, the science behind it, and how it differs from keyword searching.
Okay, well, concept searching basically is trying to group similar documents together, find documents that without being limited to nailing exactly the keyword, because keywords will miss documents. Say you were looking for, in a sports metaphor, documents about baseball, and, if you put baseball, bat, in other terms, you still might miss something with umpire or walk or home run, which are related to baseball also. So, and this is semantic clustering. This is using essentially the relationship of words, how they interact together, and sort of gluing them together to be looked at the same time. Concept searching has been around for a while. Before there was, the tools with semantic clustering, linguistic searching is a good example of concept searching. And that's when you would go out and hire someone, an expert, to think of an ontology or thesaurus of all the keywords that might relate to a topic and make sure you don't miss them. And that way you pull more of the information together. And that's a form of concept searching too. But the one that I'm talking about, semantic clustering, which is how words relate with each other using software to basically find those patterns.
So by way of example, taking your baseball analogy, if I'm doing a keyword search and I search for baseball and bat and batting average and a number of other words, I likely won't come up with a document that talks about the batting average of Sammy Sosa on the Cubs in a certain year unless it happens to contain those keywords. But if I used a concept searching tool, then I might.
That's a very good example. Yes, that's a good way to look at it.
Okay. So why is concept searching so important?
Well, for the one hand, it speeds up the review if you find the right concepts to focus on early on and get rid of those right concepts quickly. So it gets the review away from linear reviews, which are where reviewers are assigned documents based on, say, a custodian or a randomly assigned batch, and it's difficult to hone in on the issues that you're looking at when you're reviewing documents. And to highlight the difference, let's pretend a document review is like a game of cards. And in a linear review, you might shuffle the deck, and you might get dealt an ace, a two, a five, an eight, and a queen. That's a horrible hand. You need to look at each card and see how they relate to each other and figure, what you're going to do with that hand. But to use the card example with a concept search, you're trying to get four kings and maybe a wild card dealt to you at the same time. In practice, you might actually get three kings and two other face cards since concept searching tools are not perfect. But the point is, by identifying issues and assigning related documents to reviewers, it speeds up the review substantially. You can also focus your review on the higher value cards right away instead of the twos, the threes, and the fours, which is also another way to add efficiency. By the way, one reason litigation is down across the country is the high cost of litigation. So if we continue to shuffle the decks and review information haphazardly, it's no wonder that clients are folding and not gambling at litigation like they used to. But by stacking the cards in your favor and looking at related documents, you might be able to review 1,500 documents in a day, whereas random documents generally can be reviewed at, say, 300 documents in a day. That's a game of chance, which makes more sense. In addition, concept searching employed creatively is also an excellent tool for early case assessment, and I hope to talk more about that later.
And I want to talk more about that later. And one question that I have for you is former litigator myself, it seems to me one of the struggles I always had was never having enough time to focus on the documents that were key to the litigation. So if you reduce the number of hours that you're reviewing all of the documents that aren't relevant to the litigation, it gives your outside counsel more of a chance to focus on what is key. Would you say that that's an advantage of concept searching?
It's a huge advantage because you want to employ your gray matter of your litigator who you've hired because they're able to pitch a story well without mucking it up with all the extraneous information that's not that important. The faster you can get your smart people thinking about the most important documents, the better your litigation will go, less expensive it will be.
Right. What's the biggest concern that you have about concept searching?
Well, the biggest concern, and I've focused on this area now for almost a year and a half, but the biggest concern I hear is, will judges accept it, and how can I use it if I don't understand how it works? And to this I'd say, judges adapt to new arguments in law all the time. It's what they do. It's what common law is based on. It requires attorneys to advocate the benefits of what they're doing. And now with the cooperation proclamation as a widely discussed concept, there's no reason why parties can't talk about key terms and supplement this with concept searching to find documents which are missed by key terms. By being more efficient, I think it's something most judges will accept. Most parties who look at the alternatives or are experienced in e-discovery understand and accept this. And I've been fortunate to have had many noteworthy judges on ESI Bytes as guests and have yet to find a judge who disagrees with trying concept searching. It's also true with anything new that lawyers, they might actually have to advocate for an approach occasionally. And you know, to this I say, isn't that what lawyers do well? Take a position and advocate for it. And after studying this for over a year, I don't believe this is a hard argument to make given the flaws present in keyword searching. And we'll talk more about this later. But it's taking a common sense approach. As for how it works, it's important to understand these tools are based on math, as I mentioned earlier. Keyword searching is also based on math. But by looking at relationships, you can find more documents which share similar words. I dare say, to use an example, most lawyers don't understand what happens when a button is pushed in a keyword search, yet they do it all the time. And they don't understand indexing and how the tool really works that they're using. And that's okay. You know, lawyers aren't expected to be technologists. We use tools every day which we don't understand completely. Most lawyers work in large buildings. I think I can say that. You know, if you're in a 300-attorney law firm, you're probably in a big building, okay? And I bet most of them use the elevator every day. And yet, do we really understand how an elevator works? I don't. But do we understand it's more efficient than walking 20 flights of stairs? I think yes. And lastly, the proof in whether the tool's working can readily be seen just by looking at the review process. Finally, any provider of such a tool should be able to offer support and even testify if necessary to support the utility of the software they're offering.
I have two kind of follow-ups from that, in that we're talking about, you mentioned that it's important for the lawyers to understand how the tools work and whether or not, you know, they're actually gaining the concepts that they're supposed to for purposes of producing information. And it takes me back to what Judge Shenlin just said in her recent Zuba Lake Revisited opinion, the Pension Committee decision, about the fact that perfection is not what's required. And my question really to you is, do you consider it, as somebody who advocates for concept searching and works for a company that sells a concept searching tool, is it the lawyer's job, the lawyer who takes on the concept searching tool for a client, to understand how the tools work and to determine if the concept searching is getting the key documents? And should there be a constant ongoing evaluation of whether the tool is being effective?
Absolutely. You need to have a sense that the tool works, and that's just called managing a project, and that's called vetting out a tool before you buy it. That's what demos are for. That's what testing your own data on a tool is about. But you know, any review is a project, okay? And any review using any tool, you can see how things are coming along just by revisiting what people have reviewed a little bit in samples. And that's a Q&A process that's been used, I think from sort of the midpoint of e-discovery when people realize there's too much information to review. So Q&A, I think it's just a normal part of validating a review, regardless of the tool you use. And I think Q&A is a good step because, blindly following a tool doesn't make any sense to me.
Okay. Is concept searching perfect, following up on Judge Shenlin's language?
And that's the other point. No, it's not. Okay. Nothing's perfect. We've got too much information. We've got too many forms of data that are out there. You're always going to have some exception documents that don't work with the tool. And in, you know, in fact, over the course of 2009 at Juranov, we evaluated six different concept searching tools and found a variety of differences: speed of building indexes, the size of data that could be ingested by the tool, you know, number of issues which could be handled at one time, and many other issues. So it's important to have some understanding, or have at least someone on your team who understands the tool. And this can be in-house. This can also be outsourced to a technology provider. But the key in all cases is to build a process around how the tool is being used. This makes it easier to defend what you did if it ever is challenged. Plus, it makes just good business sense to come up with a plan so you're less likely to miss electronically stored information or do too much work given the needs of a particular case.
What should lawyers or lit support people or clients do if they don't understand a concept searching tool? How can they find out about a concept searching tool?
Well, you should find someone who does understand the tools. I mean, you can look around the internet, you can ask people, but you know, instead, you know, looking and evaluating new processes is a part of a field that isn't yet. There's no easy button. We haven't figured out e-discovery, so you always have to be trying to figure out better ways to do this until, and then we can standardize a little bit better. But in terms of search and retrieval, we all know keyword searching, and in the words of one of my dear friends who's been head of e-discovery at a Fortune 500 company for years, says, excuse my harsh language, but keyword searches suck. It sounds harsh, but it really captures the issue dramatically. Yet most people do it. And any study, and there have been a few that are out there that look at keyword searching, be it the Blair Marin study and finding 25% retrieval rates of information, or the Trek process each year, whichever year comes up with great examples of the flaws in just using keyword searching, these are the basis of trying something different. But there is no perfection. Don't expect perfection. And we're not held to a standard of perfection, as Judge Shinlin pointed out. But we do need to continue to try and improve. And concept searching offers tools which can be very powerful if used correctly by attorneys who understand them.
One of the arguments against concept searching, or that gives people pause with concept searching, is the notion that you're deciding that there are large categories of documents that you're not going to review. What about the concern about not looking at everything?
Well, that all comes down to the size of the case, your comfort. You know, there are a lot of factors in there, the risk involved. But you can look at everything with concept searching. The difference is that you can prioritize what you look at based on what documents look hotter. But the truth is, for many cases, especially large cases, we just can't afford to look at everything. Clients increasingly won't pay for it. Jason Barron gives great examples of his role in the White House and the size of potential cases out there. They just can't look at everything. Plus, as I've mentioned earlier, it's really quite inaccurate given the large volumes to expect people to consistently review documents the same way.
Is there a cost savings issue with concept searching? When we were out at Legal Tech in New York last month, I recall seeing Ralph Losey and Jason Barron suggesting to Judge Grimm that it will cost about $150,000 up front to save $1 million. But $150,000 is still a lot of money.
Yeah, you know, that I want to start off by saying that was a great presentation, and it was given by a group of people I consider extremely knowledgeable. They're friends. They've been great past and I hope future guests on ESI Bites, and they're really some of the best experts in the field, and I told them that. I got up the mic and said that was the best presentation I'd ever seen on concept searching at a national event. Even with all those platitudes, I'm going to say I disagree with part of their conclusions, which I know is dangerous because, you know, they might be smarter than me. But to be fair, they only had an hour to give an overview of this presentation, so I think they were very effective in what they presented, and I would guess they're not going to disagree with one of my criticisms of the presentation. And the point I would make is, if I was on the panel, I would ask why spend $150,000 as a starting point to save $1 million in review costs. And to that I say, too many times lawyers present a project to a client as what A to Z is going to cost. And there's nothing wrong with that approach. I mean, budgeting is real important. Understanding costs is the only way to offer clients fixed rates. So you got to know your cost side. And they're demanding to hear these sort of numbers and record numbers these days so they don't lose their shirts. So a total case assessment is important. But there's no reason A to Z with concept searching tools can't include and stop at A to C, using sort of the alphabet as an example. So instead of stopping, at a budget of what the entire case will cost, you could take a subset of the case. You could use concept searching as an effective preliminary assessment tool. Now, concept searching tools are much stronger, as we've talked about, than just typical keyword searches, which are found in most early case assessment tools on the market. So if you combine a concept searching tool with a technique that Sherry Harris presented on a past ESI Bytes program called e-scoping, which is focusing in early on in a case on the most likely custodians in the date ranges you think you're most interested in, then the case picture begins to emerge early on in a case. So forget about looking for the needle in the haystack in the beginning of a case. Look for that in stages S or T of the process, if I can continue with my alphabet analogy. Limit your search at the beginning of a case with ABC. Just focus in on your important custodians. As an acronym, I would use as attention begins on key custodians. So you use the concept search tools to identify clusters of issues among these custodians in the dates you care about. So now we've added a date to the ABC analysis. Then stop the rest of the expensive alphabet review and report to your client what the case looks like at ABCD. Let's go back to the card game analogy. Deal your cards, sort them into similar piles of cards, then review this sample of like cards. And hopefully you can then focus on your aces, your kings, your queens, and your jacks, which are worth more than other cards in the documents, to see what the case looks like quickly. But again, only do this for your ABCD pile of ESI. Clients can then decide after, say, $5,000 to $20,000 of analysis whether to settle and at what price, or whether to litigate, but it doesn't have to be a $150,000 price tag to save $1 million, which is what was presented at Legal Tech, to take advantage of concept searching. Then if the case goes forward, so you don't think you're wasting your time, those hot documents can then be used to seed a concept searching tool. So reviewers can look for more data that looks like those documents. It's almost like using them as magnets in a concept searching tool. So no time's wasted in this type of a workflow with early case assessment. And clients can use these tools to save money instead of making a very large investment up front to review costs.
You know, Carl, something that occurred to me as you were just answering that question is that in addition to early case assessment, you could potentially use a concept searching tool to help you identify help you scope out preservation obligations with the other side very early on in the process in a large-scale litigation where you want to make sure that you're narrowing what the preservation obligation is for the client. Do you think that concept searching would be useful in that process, maybe even by using it in sampling? I mean, we've done sampling traditional and inaccessible versus accessible, but you could say to a judge, we've used a tool to cull down the information, and we know that this is where the information is. If the other side doesn't agree, what we would agree to is let them have a sample of information prior to the date we think that's useful. And if they find stuff, and if it's stuff that you believe, rises to the burden of preservation, we'll preserve it, but here's the expense on the client. Could a concept searching tool be useful for that?
Kelly, this is why I like having you on the show, as sort of a moderator co-guest. You're an entrepreneur, and that's the point of concept searching, is to think creatively how to use these tools. I mean, I could see a workflow where you start with your initial list of possible custodians working with your HR department, and then you run what you find through concept searching. And if you're finding very little hits for certain custodians, don't look hot, maybe ask not to have to remove them from the hold. And
right.
And only focus in where you think the case is. That would be a great example of using these tools and building more effective workflow. And that's the way I advocate thinking about these. It's about the workflow. It's not as much about the tool.
Yeah, it could be a really good use for concept searching. I don't think there's not too many people I've heard thinking about it yet, but I think that could be a good potential use for the tool.
Kelly, that was your idea. I want to say that. Let's timestamp this right now, okay?
Now I just have to market it.
Okay.
So is all concept searching good then?
No. Nothing's always good except maybe water, okay? There's no easy button here. E-discovery lawyers need to think before they deploy tools, just like you were doing a second ago with trying to think of how to use this type of a tool. And you wouldn't use a gun to kill a mosquito. You could theoretically review more documents with concept search tools if you don't know what you're doing, because think about it, there are more concepts floating around in documents than documents alone in a collection. So you need to use some common sense to separate the wheat from the chaff. And that's why establishing a workflow at the beginning of a case is so important. Yeah, that's what we, you know, to personalize it, that's what we've been working really hard at Chernov, is to try to figure out. The fact is we aren't, and no one can sell a canned process here, or at least we shouldn't be. We need to look at our tools, think about what makes sense in a case. And I think on a past podcast, Tim Opsitnik, who works with me at Chernov, made an excellent point. It was the podcast with Judge Grimm, where he was talking about building your process. You look at the tools you have, you look at the case, you figure out the risks, maybe you put some sampling in, but you just build something that makes sense. And a good process can make many tools look good, and bad process can make any tool look bad. The other thing is that not all the tools work well. I remember walking around legal tech in New York a few months ago, seeing lots of concept search tools beginning to hit the market, and recall in particular one booth where the concept search tool demonstrated, which was clearly described as a beta version. I mean, they may still have been doing coding just up till the moment they opened their booth. But it just cycled, like at the time clock you see on the Microsoft application when they're thinking. And sometimes that clock just doesn't disappear, and you know you have a hung-up application. And that's what happened to this poor vendor. As a result, you shouldn't rely on a vendor's data in their demo only. Test the tool and some of your own data to see if you like the results. If you're a company which has been sued before, maybe take some of your older data and run it through an application. That's a good way to make good use of prior litigation hold data. Do the results make sense to you? How quickly does the tool work? Again, look at the people who are trying to sell the tool to you. What's their reputation? Can you get references? How helpful is the company when things don't work perfectly, which is the norm in any discovery projects? And in particular, how long does it take to index data?
And if I can add something else to your list of questions, it would be, does the vendor have 24/7 customer service?
Absolutely.
That's always a big key from an outside counsel perspective, because you're always reviewing the documents on the weekend when there's no customer service and the system crashes right before the big production has to be made. So you need that 24/7 customer service.
Sometimes you got to look at that call and say, is that a call that could have been made earlier, too?
Well, that's true, but let's be honest. Lawyers never do that, Carl. They never do that.
Anyway.
They never do that.
Yep.
Can you blindly follow what a tool tells you?
No. You need to understand the theory. And then, as we've talked a bit about, design a process around it. Back to my original analogy of getting to your office, this, again, is different from knowing how an elevator works, but you should know what buttons you need to push and what will happen if you push them, how to hit a stop button, where the phone is if you have a problem, who do you contact in that situation, you know, God forbid, where the exit is if you have to climb out in between floors. I mean, there's certain things you should know about your tool. And importantly, you know, getting back to the e-discovery tool, will that company support their tool in court if necessary, like Victor Stanley suggests, to support research your search protocol? What types of witnesses will they make? Another example of which I think is a pretty good one, of using a tool blindly versus thinking, is deciding, for example, how sampling can be used with a tool to minimize or validate a review. Using sampling creatively is one example where you can see both workflow interact with a tool. So I'd give that as an example of not just blindly following a tool.
Okay. We've talked about concept searching, and we talked about it a little bit relative to keyword searches. But, you know, where do search terms go? You go, if you move to concept searching, where do search terms go or keyword searches? Are they obsolete?
Not at all. Everyone uses keyword searches, and they're going to continue to do so. It's not a bad starting point. It is the gold standard out there in the field. And remember, at their heart, concept searches are just buckets of keywords. But understanding the limitations of purely keyword searching and how concept searching tools can supplement a keyword to find more relevant documents in close proximity to make review easier is what is important to law firms and their clients. Many concept search tools will provide lists of keywords found in a particular concept. And you can use that to see if there are keywords you're missing or if there are keywords that aren't coming up with concepts that maybe are on your list of keywords that your adversary has suggested. So you really can use concept searching alongside keyword searching. The fact that concept searching can find more information than just a keyword search, of course, raises an interesting ethical issue, which Ralph Losey and Jason Barron covered at Legal Tech, which is what to do when you see concepts which are relevant to a case but aren't specifically requested by the other side in keywords. I mean, they don't come up with the keywords. Do you bury it? Do you come forward with it? The issue I think that the panel came up with is how are you going to look to the court when this document possibly comes up later through witness and depositions or from some other method, but that's possibly a topic for another ESI Bites podcast.
You know, that could be an entire podcast in itself because I can argue both sides of that.
Yeah.
But it was a very interesting issue. I remember that presentation from Ralph and Jason, and as always, they raise all the key issues.
We all think we will do the right thing all the time.
Right, right. And yet we have an obligation to our client, so
yep.
We have to balance those two things. You know, it occurs to me in talking about this keyword searches versus concept searching that, you know, keyword searches are only going to be as good as the person or team that comes up with the keywords, right?
Yeah.
So if you have the concept searching where you don't necessarily have to come up with the keywords because it's going to pool concepts from whatever words you give it, does that equalize the playing field? Does that sort of mitigate across some lawyers who might be good at coming up with keyword searches and some that might not be?
Well, okay, possibly. I mean, there are plenty of ways to create havoc with a concept search. So, you know, it's all a question of how you're using your tool. The point I would make about keyword searching is, and Jason has a great example, Jason Barron, of one of the keywords they use to find lots of information in tobacco litigation, and it's scary Boolean. It's just scary. You look at this thing, and you're like, how the heck did a human brain come up with this? So the fact that concept searching does more of that for you, I think is probably a good thing. But I do have concerns, and I raise this at Legal Tech, with Ralph and Jason, I asked the question. I said, it's great to say you've saved $1 million, but nowhere in this presentation have you explained how you're going to use these tools to hit that savings. And
right.
I have concerns that lawyers need help. Anyone needs help to try to figure out how to use these tools effectively. And that's part of the educational process, and that's part of trial and error, and that's part of, like, your example earlier about early case assessment. It's thinking creatively. But
yeah,
I do have concerns about that area.
Well, and I think from a former outside counsel perspective, you don't have time to litigate and be up on every tool that comes out because new technologies are happening all the time. So, you know, where does that role fall? Does it fall in lit support? Does it fall with the attorney? Is it better for clients to get one tool in-house that they're familiar with than they train their outside counsel on? I mean, there's so many questions that come up in that area, but it's a challenge. I would agree with you.
We did a really, I think, an interesting podcast a couple weeks ago on whether a law firm should insource e-discovery expertise or outsource it because of the constant changing nature of technology. And it was Chris Olson from Cricket Legal Technology and Stephanie Amal from Keating, Muthing, and Kleekamp in Cincinnati were talking about this. And the fact is some firms have better skill sets than others to attack this issue in-house. And some firms, you know, might try it without the skill sets and probably will get burnt. And some firms are going to avoid this issue entirely because they know they don't have the skill set or knowledge, and maybe they'll continue using just keyword searching. But those aren't your only solutions. You can outsource these skills. And because technology is different from the practice of law, it's not taught in law schools, and most lawyers don't really have the background to learn technology, it's perfectly fine, though, to look to technology companies to supplement your internal knowledge. You know, I've always said in e-discovery, going back to discovery land, which is the point of the board game, that collaboration is a huge key in effective e-discovery process. And it's not just with the opposing side, which is what the cooperation proclamation suggests parties to do. I see collaboration as building a multifaceted skilled team to attack ESI problems. And this is where outsourcing can make sense for most law firms, because until they become comfortable with how a tool works, there's really nothing wrong with admitting we don't know everything about e-discovery. It's just too big and complicated a field. It's legal, it's technology, it's people skills, you know, there's common sense, there's some entrepreneurship. I don't know anyone who has all those skills, including myself. You know, as a result, team building and project management is perhaps the most critical piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, I would agree with you that those challenges of bringing all those skills together is the biggest roadblock to making reducing risk and achieving compliance with legal obligations and being efficient with resources, you know, money and time. What final advice do you have for the listeners?
Well, as Judge Facciola said on one of the ESI Bytes podcasts, it's okay to experiment in e-discovery. Just know why you're experimenting. And if you make a mistake, just acknowledge it and explain what you were trying to do. I know of no case where good intentions, which are documented, have resulted in sanctions. And also, experimenting is the only way we can improve in this area, and improving is something which I think everyone agrees is necessary in e-discovery. So the tools for concept searching just show such great promise. That's why we should look at them. And, you know, I actually, that's why, you know, Tim brought me on at Jurinov, and that's why we focused on it for the last year and a half. So I think that's probably a good way to conclude. At least we think it's real important, and I hope this helps people see why.
Absolutely. I think that you've done a great job in shedding some light on what the benefits are of concept searching, why you need to think about them, and the issues that you need to think about in using concept searching tools versus keyword searching. So thanks, Carl, for joining us as a guest for the first time on ESI Bytes today.
Boy, Kelly, thanks for moderating, allowing me to be a guest, and hopefully not put me out of a job.
Well, I don't think that's going to happen. I sure appreciate the opportunity and feel privileged to have been the first moderator other than yourself on ESI Bytes, and hopefully there will be other guest moderators to come.
You know, I'm going to make a quick plug here. Judge Grimm is going to co-host with me. We're doing a show with law students in about 4 weeks where we ask them about e-discovery and what their thought is, since the next generation may be smarter than us. But anyway, hey, why don't
Great.
You end the show for me here?
Absolutely.
Is your final job interview question. Can you end ESI Bytes the right way?
All right. To the listeners, if you have enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com for a complete list of the podcasts available there. That is ESIBYTES. You can also remember our show and website phonetically as Easy Bytes of ESI Information. However you choose to remember ESI Bytes, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about e-discovery and before ESI bites you back.
Great. Thanks. I appreciate you ending the show. You did wonderful. And we'll do more shows in the future.
Thanks, Carl.